am Alan Gervey, and this is Gervey's Law. So, over the last several years, I've interviewed the late F. Lee Bailey, Robert Shapiro, Alan Dershowitz several times, Christopher Darden, which you'll want to hear about, and I have left the best for last.
I bet you say that to all the Simpson lawyers.
I absolutely do not. I did not say it to any of the others, but I am so pleased and honored to have with us. And I've been waiting a long time because those interviews have gone over several years. And now we have Marcia Clark. Everyone knows Marcia Clark as the former prosecutor, but some people don't realize, Marcia, that you are a best-selling New York Times author. You've written numerous books, 9 legal thrillers, and you've been a TV correspondent, a producer. You've done commentary on a number of trials over the years. So there really has been life after OJ in a big way. And that's why I'm really happy to have you here. We want to talk about your new book, Trial by Ambush, Murder, Injustice, and the Truth About the Case of Barbara Graham. Before we do that, first of all, welcome to Gervey's Law.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad to have you. So let's dish a little bit. So when F. Lee Bailey was on, he had some choice words for some of his dream teammates. He said that the reason that Robert Shapiro left really quickly when the verdict was announced was because he had tried to broker a deal the night before, and he had tried to twist the arms of all the defense people to get OJ to do some prison time. But F. Lee Bailey would not have it. F. Lee Bailey said, I knew he was not going to be found guilty, and I encouraged OJ to not listen to Robert Shapiro. So when the acquittal was announced, he took off. And F. Lee Bailey said, you know, I have a picture in my office, obviously before he passed away, and said, that picture is me and OJ, and Robert's running out of the courtroom. What is your thought on that? And can you tell us anything? I'm not asking you to divulge any privileges or anything, but is there anything to what F. Lee Bailey was saying to me?
I have no idea. I didn't know about any of that. And I wouldn't know, because that's all that is privileged. All that stuff that he's telling you about the advice given by a lawyer to the client and the lawyer running out the door. The lawyer running out the door is not privileged, but giving advice to Simpson to plead guilty, do some jail time, all that, that's privileged. And I would not know that.
And maybe that's why F. Lee Bailey was disbarred, divulging attorney-client privilege. But were there discussions at the time that you were aware of that may have avoided the verdict?
No, I never was. All I ever thought was this is going to trial. I mean, it's a double homicide. The sentence is life without the possibility of parole. There was no real option for any kind of plea bargain in a situation like that case. So as far as I knew, that was never on the table.
Okay. So, you know, I can't cross-examine F. Lee Bailey now, obviously, but he also said that Alan Dershowitz left before the verdict was announced the night before because of a Jewish holiday. I can't remember if it was Yom Kippur or Rosh Hashanah, because it was in October, I believe. Were you aware of that? Did you have any insight into what was going on the other side with who was going to be there and who wasn't?
No, and I didn't care. I knew Simpson had to be there, that was for sure. And that was about all I knew.
You know, Chris Darden spoke a lot about you in my interview with him. And he was asked about your relationship. And before he answered, he said, what did Marcia say about me? And I said, well, I haven't talked to Marcia yet. So a few years later, now we're talking. and he wants to know what you thought about him. He mentioned that you went up to San Francisco, I think, did a little dancing, had some fun. He said the way we looked at each other, we really liked each other, but that was about it. He wants to know what you thought of him.
I don't remember the dancing part, but I do remember, I do remember going, it was like, I did not have the kids that weekend. It, you know, the stress and the misery of that trial is really hard to describe. He was like the best partner. He was, we were trench mates. And I don't think there was anybody in the world that could understand better what we were going, what I was going through than Chris. And there were so many nights that we came back from court and I would just be flattened. We know we're going to lose this. We're going to lose this. This is hopeless. And he was he was my rock. You know, he really, you know, we can do it. We can do it. The jury's going to see the truth. We can do it. Kept me from really, you know, he was the support that I couldn't have had from anyone else. And he was there and he was wonderful. He was really just a great partner. And on that weekend, it was just like, let's escape. Let's just get out of here. And anywhere we went in California would have been better than Los Angeles. And it was. I mean, we were up in the Bay Area. No one cared. No one cared. And that's why I would go and visit friends of mine that lived in Santa Barbara. No one cared. They'd see me. They knew who I was. They, you know, right. Watched TV. It's hard right. to avoid us. We were on TV all the time. I felt sorry for everyone. Sorry, I didn't mean to be. Yeah, they didn't ask me about being on TV 24/7.
Well, I'm going to ask you about that, but go ahead.
But they didn't bother me. They never bother. That's the wrong word. But, you know, they never came up to me, or if they did, it was very cool and very nice. And there wasn't any big deal made of it. And there was no tabloid or paparazzi or any of that hanging around. So getting out of Los Angeles was always a good thing. And so that trip to the Bay Area was a breath of air that we could breathe without worrying about who was sticking a camera, you know, over our shoulders.
You know, in all seriousness, when Chris was talking about not only your relationship, and I think he was saying it half, you know, tongue in cheek, but he said that a lot of things that were said about him, he took very personally and he resented it. He talked about being called an Uncle Tom and certain criticisms that were made of the prosecution team and him personally. He said to this day, he has never really been able to accept it. Did you feel the same way? A lot of people had things to say. That's what happens to us as an attorney. When you are in the public eye, when trials are on TV, the cameras in the courtroom, people are going to make comments. People are going to either try and say, you know, you're weak, you're strong, you're not. I like your curly hair. I like your straight hair. How did you react to what was being said? And did you take it personally?
Well, I'm a person. So, of course, I took it personally. And they were commenting
well,
on
well, you
my
don't
person.
Have to take it personally. I mean, sometimes, you know, some people are just kind of machines, lawyers. I know a lot of them. They have no personality. And even though they say they're a person, I'm like, hello, anyone home? But you have a great personality.
That's very kind of you. But I mean, how to explain? I had not anticipated that it would be as crazy as it was. I did not expect it to be the kind of circus that it became. I had never been exposed to that before. No case that I had ever tried was like that. And nor could it be, because I think technology actually caught up with us in terms of 24/7 news cycle that had not been happening before. And then it all came together in the Simpson case. So there was kind of a coincidence of timing, if you will. Being that kind, I think what was awful to me was the personal focus, that people would comment on my lawyering and what they thought of how the case was going, you know, whatever, that's fine. They get to, you know, but that I personally, or that Chris personally, were the focus of that kind of attention, especially Chris, was horrifying, really unfair and terrible. Really terrible. I don't know that it would be any better today. In some respects, it would be worse because, you know, you have the internet and you have X and you have and all that, you know. On the other hand, what would be better today would be that you would have dissenting voices. You would have people with different points of view, different opinions. Back then, there was a real attitude for the longest time. People would be afraid to even voice an opinion that Simpson was guilty. They would say, oh, I can't make up my mind. I haven't seen all the evidence. And I would just laugh. You're not on the jury. I understand right. If you're a juror. No, you can't. You can't form an opinion until all the evidence is in. That's right. But you're not. You're not on the jury. You can have an opinion. But people were afraid to because it was such a hot button topic. And don't forget, it had just, LA had just been burning. We had just had the Rodney King riots after those officers were acquitted of the beating. So it was, the temperature in Los Angeles was sky high. And there was a great deal of tension in the air. So there was that going on as well, and that didn't help matters.
You know, from what I can see, you have put your heart and soul in anything you have done, and we're about to talk about Trial by Ambush, your book, and I know you spent so much time going through trial transcripts, maybe 4,000 pages, to get to the truth, the persistence of trying to find truth with a big T, a capital T, versus what you've described as, you know, media or hearsay or hyperbole or rhetoric. But there you are saying, I want to get to the truth. Do you believe that going back to the OJ trial, which you did, I'm sure the same way that you researched your books, including Trial by Ambush, do you think you did everything you could have to prepare properly? Because a lot of attorneys don't. I mean, I'm in court. I was in trial today, actually. And the other attorney didn't know the case. And I was so resentful of that. But here you are, you know, doing everything you're supposed to and not getting the best result. How do you deal with that? And do you have those kind of resentments that I do?
I didn't. I had a great team. So, and everybody worked so hard. I mean, day and night and day and night. And there was just no end to the amount of work that we did. And there was no decision there that There was a great deal of discussion about what evidence to be admitted, what evidence should we not, what, you know, that kind of thing. And so I really did feel like we left it on the field. You know, we did all that we could and then some. Had some of the best lawyers in the DA's office, you know, not just Chris, but Brian Kelberg and Hank Goldman. And, you know, I mean, we had an amazing team, an amazing team, Sherry Lewis. And we really, and everybody worked so hard. So no, I don't have that kind of regret, honestly. And I really did walk away feeling, look, if they're going to acquit him, there was nothing that we could ever have done. And
do,
I really
do you think, you know, you used the analogy, left it on the field. Do you think maybe the refs screwed up?
Oh, in many respects, but that's not, you know, playing the blame game is easy to do. Everybody makes mistakes. Me too. Every single day. Right. And every single day in trial, as you know very well, you know, how should I object? Should I not object?
Yeah, exactly.
You know, I mean, and these are second by second decisions that you're making. Should I ask this question, not ask this question? You know, that kind of thing. These decisions get made constantly, hundreds of them every single day when you're in trial. You're bound to make mistakes. You're bound to fail to object when you should have or object when you shouldn't have, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, mistakes were made. At the end of the day, though, you have to, can you step away? The important thing is to be able at the end of the day to step away and say, I did all I could. I'm not perfect, God knows, but I did all that I could to see to it that the jury saw the truth or had the truth available to them and to do the right thing. And if they choose not to, then they choose not to.
You know, I've learned a long time ago not to second guess myself, although it's a natural thing to do, because some of the decisions that you're talking about on the spur of the moment, they can go either way. And there's a lot of strategy that goes in. Sometimes I don't object because I don't want to stop the train of thought that's going on with my client on the stand or if there's a cross-examination. So there's a lot of things that go in, even though you feel, well, it probably is objectionable. It doesn't mean you have to. So I think it's a maturity that lawyers need to have in order to move forward. And obviously, you were tested in probably the most dramatic and impactful way because, you know, here you are with a great team doing everything you can. And then maybe the result just isn't what a lot of people expected.
Right. And we were much more ready for that verdict, I think, than the public at large, because we had been confronted with focus groups and all kinds of advisors that were looking at the, putting their finger in the air and saying, not great. And that started actually within 2 days of the murders. When I got the case, I remember calling Sherry. She was working down in Compton, which
right.
was a heavily minority area. And she said, I said, you know, wow, we've got a lot of evidence already. It's amazing. When Phil Van Etter called me to say, can you, here's what we got for the search warrant. He kind of riffed through the summary of what he had in terms of evidence to see if he had enough for a search warrant. I said, you've got enough to file the case. I've never seen so much evidence in a case this early in the investigation. And I told Sherry, it's a great case. And she said, yeah, Marcia, it's not sounding good over here. I'm telling you right now, nobody likes this. And sure enough, I mean, and in the beginning, there wasn't even a racial divide in the feelings about the case. Everyone hated us and did not want to believe that their hero was capable of doing this. So it was an uphill battle from day one. And the possibility of not getting a verdict at all seemed very, very, very likely. The best we could do was a hung jury. And it's very hard to walk into court every day and keep fighting knowing that. But to say that we were,
I was going to say, what a great segue to Barbara Graham's story. So this is trial by Amazon. And, you know, we can talk about who had a fairer trial, Barbara Graham or O.J. Simpson. But let's talk a little bit about Trial by Ambush, because by all accounts, people love the book. It was recently released. I read the reviews on Goodreads. I mean, I have the book. I read it. But, you know, I'm only one person. I want to look and see what the jury I don't know if I should say the jury, how the jury is going to give that verdict. And by all accounts, reviews are incredible. Goodreads, Amazon, and any of the places that you go to look for your books, and you find that people are saying not only is it well-written, insightful, it's engaging, but the story is really incredible, and not a lot of people know the story. They've maybe seen, what was it, a 1953 movie about Barbara Graham's story, but they don't know the ins and outs and how you presented it. How is it when you write a book like that, and this is your first venture into the true crime story, how do you go about making it so engaging from a story that maybe was the trial of the century a long time ago, not this century? So how did you approach that to be able to get this result?
It was funny. I had never heard of Barbara Graham. I didn't know about the film I Want to Live. And when I first kind of saw her case mentioned, I was looking at a totally different case, not at all thinking about Barbara Graham. And then saw that case and then saw very quickly that it had been the subject of this Oscar-winning film. Susan Hayward won Best Actress for playing Barbara Graham. And I thought that actually was something that made me think I'm never going to write this book, because obviously everybody and his dog would have written about this book. Forget it. But I thought, well, let me just see. And it turned out that they hadn't. It was really surprising. And the only book that I saw that was really devoted to the entirely devoted to the case was this very slim volume written by a reporter who'd covered written the tabloid stories about the trial and the case itself. And it was, I found, very inaccurate in some respects. Just without even knowing anything about the case, I saw that there were things said there that made no sense. I thought, well, really then, I guess the field is open. And the only book I found that talked, that wrote accurately about Barbara Graham was Proof of Guilt by Kathleen Cairns, who's excellent. I really recommend the book. It's about the death penalty, though, and other cases as well, and not about the trial. So I wanted to write about the trial because what little I was able to find, even online, about Barbara Graham did not fit with this heinous robbery murder. It was a home invasion robbery.
Right.
With Barbara Graham and four other men. Barbara was just the decoy meant to persuade the victim, but Mabel Monahan, in her 60s, who's living in this little suburban neighborhood, very quiet neighborhood, living by herself in her 60s. But very security conscious. She had been a vaudeville trooper, and her husband was as well. They toured the
A
country.
roller skater?
She was a roller skater.
I love that.
Me too. And her husband was a roller skater and ice skater. They became a dynamic duo performing on the vaudeville circuit. Very cool. And then she wound up in this house that was given to her by her daughter after her daughter divorced this casino entrepreneur, Tudor Scherer, who left it to her in the divorce. And she didn't want it. She gave it to her mother, Mabel, the first time she ever had a house. And she was very security conscious, didn't want to open the door. So the rumors were that Mabel Monahan had a stash of money there because Tudor Scherer, the casino operator and real estate entrepreneur, would come there to visit her often from Las Vegas. They were sure that he was stashing money there, which it turned out was not true at all. But they brought along a box man. That's what they called a safe cracker back then. They were sure she had a safe with all his money in it. And Barbara was meant to be the decoy that would get her to open the door because she was beautiful and she was petite and she looked as non-threatening as you can imagine. So she came in that night and knocked on the door and said, "Oh, my car broke down. Could you just let me use your phone, please? I'll just use your phone and I'll leave. I'm broken down and I have nowhere to go." And Mabel opened the door. She opened the door for Barbara and the men came in behind her. And she was later found pistol whipped, bludgeoned, strangled to death, blood on the walls, blood on the floor. The whole house was turned upside down. They had even gone through all the purses in her closet, with the exception of one that was hanging on the hook. And in that purse was found hundreds of dollars and expensive jewelry, diamonds, gold, platinum. Why they left that, and the police had no physical evidence, no witnesses. And then they find this purse loaded with cash and prizes. And they say, now I don't know, we don't even know why. It looks like a robbery, but they left all that. So it was a case that had a huge amount of attention right from the start, because it was such a shocking thing in a quiet neighborhood like that, which, by the way, was just 2 miles away from where I lived at the time of the Simpson trial. And there was an outcry about how could this possibly happen in this very safe neighborhood. So the police were under a lot of pressure to break the case. And they put out their feelers everywhere. And ultimately, I mean, it took a couple weeks, which was a long time back then.
Right.
And they reached some informants who knew something and heard something. They kept pushing the rumor mill and eventually did break the case that way.
But don't you think that even back then, we don't know what the truth is? And obviously you did, because you did all the research. You went through so many pages of the trial transcript. What were you hoping to find that was different than what you had heard about, which was probably a minimal amount of information?
So initially, I saw what Barbara's past was. She was she had been the victim of abuse and neglect as a child, really basically abandoned by her mother from birth. She never knew who her father was. Her mother went on to have two more children with unknown fathers.
Was that all through the testimony at the trial?
No, that was the background I was able to find online.
Okay.
And through Kathleen's book. That never came into evidence at the trial. But that's what I saw before I even got to the trial transcripts. It took me a long time to get them because they were in the archives, because this was a 70-year-old case. Very hard to find. I was afraid I wouldn't get them at all. Who knows what happens to those transcripts, even if they try to keep them. So what was weird to me is that Barbara had this misdemeanor background that's very common among people who are raised with no means, you know, impoverished and had no skill set, barely went to school. So she had been a shoplifter and she'd written bad checks. She'd had maybe even done some prostitution here and there. But violence? No violence in her background whatsoever. Nor was she even involved with anybody who was violent that she could have known. So it made no sense that she was being framed up. As I could see from the newspaper articles, she was stood up as being the linchpin, the main player in the case, and the one who pistol whipped Mabel Monahan. And that this doesn't fit. The guys that she was arrested with certainly
didn't. If it doesn't fit, they must acquit.
Oh, I knew you were going to do that.
You walked right into it.
I did. I set you up, and you're welcome.
Thank you. Go ahead.
But Jack Santos and Emmett Perkins were both, she didn't know this, but they had been murderers for quite some time. Thieves, murderers, they were the worst of the worst. They made sense. You looked at them, you could see what they were, and they were all of that. She wasn't. And that's what made me say, I've got to see what happened in this trial. How did this happen? How did she wind up in the gas chamber? It's just, it doesn't fit. And so I looked at then the getting all of the evidence and getting those trial transcripts. What a wild ride that was. And as a lawyer, you know, you read what other people are doing, you see the work they do.
Right.
So the prosecutor, the lead prosecutor in this case was J. Miller Levy, who was an icon in the LADA's office, very famous, prosecuted Carol Chessman, prosecuted the first nobody homicide, L. Ewing Scott. It was a big deal. It was one of those things where, wow, J. Miller Levy, I'll get to see the icon in action. I was very excited about that. Then I saw him in action, and I was more than
disappointed.
Disappointed is putting it mildly. I got so angry and so upset at all the unfairness.
Yeah.
I mean, he went after her hammer and tong in a way that I have never seen a prosecutor go after any defendant, even the worst of the worst.
Really?
The way he went after her was, something.
Do you
really
think
unfair.
That is partially why she was executed? Because of that?
Yes. Oh, absolutely. No question about it. He vilified and demonized her in every single way he could. The judge could have put a stop to it, could have put the brakes on at some point, never did. Levy got away with everything, including hiding key evidence that would have impeached his star witness, the accomplice John True, or as I call him, the ironically named John True,
True.
Who was the biggest liar I'd ever seen.
True
so,
that.
Yeah, true that. Really, a lot of things. Then, you know, Alan, back in the day, a lot of things were allowed that it would not be today.
Right, right.
So, and I do account for that in the book.
And, you know, I want to say, and sorry to interrupt, but I think what you did in the OJ trial really accounts for what you're talking about. The juxtaposition from trying a case back then to now, because the cameras are there, they're seeing what's going on, and maybe they wouldn't get away with what they did in the past, as you're talking about in the Barbara Graham trial.
But they would, except they would, because the cameras don't prevent the judge from ruling badly. The cameras don't prevent the judge from making bad calls. So, and that's what I'm talking about in Barbara's case. The prosecution was getting away with all kinds of shenanigans that I think
you don't
really
think there would have been pressure from the media at all and from people?
There wasn't.
Well, because there was no camera. There was no camera in the courtroom.
But there was a courtroom packed with reporters. Everybody was watching. The whole world was watching through these reporters. Yeah. So you don't need to have a camera to know what's going on. And the reporters were actually putting out editions in the morning, noon, and night. I mean, they were constantly flooding the market with reports, daily reports of what was going on in the trial. And that's why it became a national sensation. And especially here in Los Angeles, the courtroom was packed with spectators and lined up down the courtroom hallways every single day because it was such a celebrated case. And it was so wild with all the twists and turns that were being reported. So, no, I mean, the pressure, the presence of cameras and the presence of reporters can't force the judge to rule correctly and can't stop the lawyers from pulling dirty tricks.
And isn't it ironic that you, as a former prosecutor, can say that, criticizing the prosecution and the unfairness of the trial?
But it's all about the truth. It's all about justice.
I agree.
It's all about, you know, I mean, it doesn't matter what side of the lawsuit you're on. And actually, as a prosecutor, you have a duty not to play dirty tricks, not to pull a fast one, not to hide the evidence or skew the evidence in a way that unfairly damages the defendant. You know, you're going to damage the defendant with every piece of incriminating evidence you put on, but that's your job. You're supposed to present the evidence against him, or else what are you doing in court? But to go after someone personally, the way Levy went after Barbara Graham, that's a whole different story.
And I think that I was going to say that's why you are who you are. Because you recognize it, you write this book that exposes that, and a lot of attorneys wouldn't do that, believe me. A lot of attorneys wouldn't look for truth, for justice, for fairness, and I hate to say it because I've been in the profession for a long time, but that's what's special not only about your character, because you've proven it over and over again through your career, but also writing your books, looking for that truth and fairness, which we don't see.
But we should.
Of course we should. Of course we should.
But wait, Alan.
You need to get back into practice. You need to get back into the courtroom.
I am so in practice.
I understand that. But you know what I mean. You need to follow me for a few days, and you'll see and why people can't look at things honestly.
No, when I say I am in practice, I really literally mean I am a practicing defense attorney. That's what I do. I do appellate work, court-appointed appeals. So as you know, we'll tell your audience, when you're convicted of a felony, and I think that's probably across the country, not just California.
Right.
Once you're convicted of a felony, you're entitled to a direct appeal free of charge. The Court of Appeal appoints lawyers to represent you on appeal. And it's all in writing. And in order to process an appeal on direct appeal, I review all the transcripts and I write up the errors that happened, the judge's errors, the lawyer's errors, whatever it is, doesn't matter. And that's what we do. And to me, I mean, I love this practice because it's as close as you can get to the pure practice of law. It is just about the
That's
law
right.
and the evidence, you know, and so I really love doing that. And I was able to use the experience I have. I've been doing it for like 16 years now in writing this book and bring the same experience to bear in saying, okay, see, this is wrong. This shouldn't have happened. The judge should have done this and that kind of thing. But that's what we do. We're error catchers, basically. So there's that whole layer of review after you get done in court where others are looking at what happened and theoretically, hopefully, trying to right the wrong that may have happened in trial.
Wow.
Obviously, you know, but you're in trial court. You're still doing the
yes.
trials.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And yeah. I agree with everything you've said. I just find that a lot of times when you're talking to lawyers, not necessarily in pleadings or written word, there are some less than honest people. Let's just leave it at that. That, you know, I love doing what you're doing because when I write, I can write everything I need to say and use my research and everything without someone interrupting me and saying, wait a second, this and that, which I found in court today in my trial. The other attorney just kept interrupting. And finally, the judge said, you know, let Mr. Gervey speak. Let him speak. So when you're writing what you're doing, you're actually having that opportunity to speak.
That's really true. I never thought of it like that, Alan, but I think you're right.
I think it is
And
true.
It is nice. But what's tough is when we have oral argument before the Court of Appeals, that is tough because the person saying, wait a minute, is the justice.
Justice, yeah.
And you can't say.
But that's what you prepare
that.
For. That's why you're Marcia Clark, because you can handle a justice saying, have you thought about this, though?
And oh, boy, do they.
And that makes you think, which you have to prepare for. And you've prepared amazingly for this book. I hope everyone gets a chance to read it. They can get it at, Amazon Publishing? You can
get it on Amazon. You can get it at all your bookstores. It's all over the place.
Everywhere. And look at the reviews because they're amazing. Check out your Instagram, which is at that Marcia Clark. Not this one, that one.
That
and
one.
I point to you. Last question. Do you have any other books that are coming out or in your mind that you're thinking about doing in the future?
I do want to do another true crime book. I really enjoyed diving into someone else's case, not my own, and just being able to sit back and look at what happened and also talk about the larger issues that it raises. Like, you know, the best case to write about is one that, like this one, brings up issues that are still current. You know, the impact of the media, the way in which the press can treat a woman in an unusual role like this one, like Barbara.
The book is Trial by Ambush, Marcia Clark. You know, I've waited a long time to have this interview, and I had to listen to Chris Darden, Alan Dershowitz, F. Lee Bailey, Robert Shapiro. All of these people listen to their versions, and I'm finally so glad that I had the opportunity to talk to you today, not only about O.J. case and those other attorneys, but also, of course, about your new book. So congratulations on that and good luck. We'll be looking for the next true crime story with a great, great trial that's really enticing and engaging from Marcia Clark. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Alan. It was a pleasure.
Take care. And that's it for Gervey's Law. See you again on our next episode. Bye for now.